You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded, and current lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Thanks for listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting out to you from Musqueam Territory. Our opening song today was Care by Mitch Cota.
Today's episode is about Indigenous women writers, specifically the politics of writing. And we're lucky enough to have director, writer, and actor Kim Senclip Harvey with us in studio. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
So let's go around and introduce ourselves, and I'll just start. I'm Jamuna Gale Tamang. I'm Nepali, Dene Métis, and Ukrainian, and I was born very close to here on Tsleil-Waututh territory.
I'm Jess. I'm from Madison, home of the Potawatomi, Ho-Chunk, Ojibwe, Menominee, Kickapoo, and Sauk Indigenous peoples.
No, Nesta'an Kwetasawet. I'm Steph Wood. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation, and I was born and raised on Squamish territory.
I'm Amanda, and I'm a settler from the Chicago suburbs, the traditional territories of the Miami, Potawatomi, and Peori peoples. I live and study here on the unceded Coast Salish territories.
Honita Kim Satsade Hesnan Kaini Hesnan Jen Sukutin Silk Takel Kutnaha Chenanya Limalit. I, too, am a guest here on the unceded territories of the Coast Salish people.
This is the second episode of our two-part series on Indigenous women writers. Be sure to find part one on CITR.ca or at Google Podcasts. We talked a lot about the creative process of writing, and we'll touch on that today, but we're also talking about the political action of writing.
We're beginning a conversation with Kim, and later we'll listen to a reading by journalist Tanya Talaga. Her work in Thunder Bay has gained her critical acclaim, and Jamuna had a chance to speak with her when she did a Massey lecture. We'll have a lot to talk about after listening to her speak.
We're so lucky to have Kim in studio with us today. She wrote and directed the play Kamlupa, which just finished its tour, and she's returned here to BC. This matriarchal play follows two Indigenous sisters and their trickster friend, who they meet along the way. They take a journey of self-discovery to Kamlupa, the largest powwow on the West Coast. But as it says on Kim's website, how do you discover yourself when Columbus already did that? Okay, Kim, how about we start with a general question? Why Kamlupa? And where'd you get the idea for the play from?
Originally, it came out of a broken leg and sitting in my parents' house, feeling pretty kind of depressed around my state. I was about to move to Seattle to play roller derby at a competitive level. And I was moving away from theater because I was really... I was really hurt by the way Western theater had treated me and my people and the stories that it was telling, and I was disillusioned and not confident in the fact that I think Canadian theater and the systems and structure could actually hold the stories and the methodologies that I wanted to do. Western Canada theater into Kamloops had a commission out, and I was sitting in bed really trying to figure out my life. I feel like there were a bunch of teachings being offered to me. It was the second time I'd broken my leg in 12 months, and so I feel like it was the ancestors telling me that I needed to stay where I was. And Kamlupa came out of just that I wanted to start telling Indigenous matriarch stories that was the full scope of who we are. I was an actor. I finished my BFA here at UBC in 2008, and then I worked for almost 3 years straight, predominantly doing trauma-informed narratives, where I kind of said all I'm being asked to do is die or cry. And I didn't think that was honest and an honest depiction of the women that I knew in my life. And I kind of took a break from it. In full transparency, I was in Toronto, in Decoronto, and I was kind of at the end of my leash. I was partying too hard. the content of these shows had taken a spiritually had taken a lot from me, and the structures and the approach to holding these women that I was being asked to play was not one conducive to health and wellness and spiritual wholeness. And I left to go do child advocacy. So I work for the Ministry of Children and Family, and then I was the youth manager for the Representative for Children and Youth, teaching children in foster care their rights under Section 70. Because I was done with theater. So Kamloopa is out of two things. One, that I don't think we were being full in how Indigenous women were being represented on stage. And two, I wanted to change the methodology around how Indigenous women were being represented on stage. And Kamloopa for me was, I wanted three whole full women that didn't necessarily follow the well-made play structure, where we didn't talk about dramatic action and a climax and it be presentation deliverable heavy, but rather process-based around giving Indigenous matriarchs and primarily women and non-binary identifying genders to have a voice in decision making in the room. So it's threefold. It's the community work, it's the methodology, and then it's also the artistic practice, which is what we ended up calling Kamloopa, which was artistic ceremony. So sovereignty and agency, why Kamloopa, I think.
Oh my gosh, there's so much there, and I want to ask so many questions. I mean, you just mentioned at the end about ceremony, and that was such an important part for me as a viewer. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about how you approached it, thinking about ceremony and treating it like ceremony.
Yeah, for me, when I decided to come back to theater, I kept asking questions around why. Why are we communing? Why are we coming into these spaces? What are the values around that? This idea of a ticket and it being performative felt really anti-Indigenous. It felt like it didn't ask for all of myself to be present. And as an Indigenous woman and a person who's journeying on my own decolonial Indigenizing practices, I wanted to build a venue for all of that to be embraced and celebrated. And Kevin Loring and Halemia Sparrow, who are mentors of mine, talk about storytelling being our medicine. It is where we would come to heal. It is how we relate to each other. It's how we bear witness to each other. And that, to me, is intrinsically ceremonial, and there are protocol around that. And I leaned hard into that to try and create that in a Eurocentric kind of Western form of theater, but incubated that with this idea of Indigenous artistic ceremony, that we had to have protocol to protect this medicine and the ceremony of what we were doing, because I think ultimately that's what we all used to do when we used to tell stories and gather around the fire. If you go far enough back, for all of us, it was tribal. It was fires were a place of gathering. They were a place of communing. They were a place of checking in about our values, about where's our community at. And I wanted to protect that because I knew that Canadian theater is oppressive. It's saturated. It's omnipresent. And so protocol and Indigenizing the process was very much about protecting what we were trying to do, to give us agency from inception all the way to, you know, we kind of use this fire framework to extinguishing the fire, which is where we're at now. But I had a lot of pushback. People were saying, well, you're selling tickets, you're holding in a theater, and yada yada. And my friend and Dr. Lindsay LaChance, who just had her PhD here in Indigenous relational dramaturgy, talked about the fact that, well, settlers have ceremonies all the time, and they aren't being questioned around how they are created. Weddings are ceremony for them, and weddings have evolved very much so. And so why can't we be creating Indigenous artistic ceremony? And a prevailing message I kept saying at the end of these the shows and at talkbacks, and was saying that our ancestors are waiting for us to create ceremony. They're sitting in the audience with us. They're sitting in this space right now. They're waiting for us to create ceremony. We did that for thousands and thousands of years. My dad always says, you know, we didn't bang the same drum song for 10,000 years. And I think a big symptom of colonization and white oppression and patriarchy and capitalism is trying to distract Indigenous people, distract Indigenous matriarchs from having the confidence and the agency to create ceremony. I think that has to happen more. And we got a couple traditionalists who we knew were going to come at us saying, you can't do this. And I know that comes from a place of deep fear, because we have been so hurt by colonization and white supremacy. And I tried to meet that with as much respect and love as I could. But I know my ancestors are waiting for us to create artistic ceremony. It is what is going to propel us, sustain us, and steward in that next generation of young artists and Indigenous matriarchs to reflect and be nimble enough and responsive to where we're at in the society right now. So I think that's the only way I'll work moving forward is holding this work in ceremony and protocol out of safety, and out of a deep respect for all of my ancestors who have done so much to allow me to be here.
I went to the play with my auntie and my mother, and they both were blown away, and really they appreciated everything about it and that opening. And one thing I was really struck about as well was when it begins and the three women stand there and they address the audience and say that you're here bearing witness, and that I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that action of being a witness.
Yeah, I don't know if like people's witnessing protocols are probably really unique to their own people. And that's the other thing, too, I want to just preface this whole conversation with, is that this artistic ceremony and this idea of Indigenous matriarchal and protocol creation is intrinsically connected to who I am. And it's an offer to the rest of the community. But if we were all to create our own pieces of art, and I believe our lives as the art, our protocols would be unique to who we are. That is not a pan-Indigenous formula for every artist to use ever. In fact, that's what would be another continuation of colonization, is that we need to go out and spend time to figure out what our own protocol and ceremonial work is. Witnessing, Samantha Brown mentions that off the top, is an active role. And I think versus an audience member where you kind of just sit there, consume, receive, walk home, ticket goes into the garbage and that's it, it's quite passive. And again, if we go back to sitting around the fire, you know, Jimin, if you were to speak and tell us your story about where you were, and I was bearing witness to this, I would have a responsibility to respond in a way that was meaningful and authentic and relational. And then I would be a knowledge holder. And I was craving that from Canadian theater. I was craving a level of engagement and responsibility and role taking so that people would actually go beyond the proscenium, is kind of what we called it. Jessica Schacht called it extending the edges, that there has to be a negotiation of relationship in the art. Otherwise, it's just consumer deliverable based, which is, again, I think, anti-Indigenous. We are community based. We are relational based. We are functional based in the sense that we're supposed to be there for each other. And that's what, to me, what I know witnessing protocol to be is an act of responsibility. To once I'm being gifted, like, you know, Yolanda Benel calls it as a teaching, when you're gifted a teaching, you then have to hold that teaching and you're responsible to share it with others. Otherwise, we're just hoarding that knowledge. And that is, again, like, not how we remained and continue to be so prosperous and successful and powerful, is that as knowledge holders, and I believe that to firmly be a matriarchal quality, is that we then gift it to others, that it's our responsibility to share it. That's, we're an oral people, and that was really important to me. And, you know, I'm interested to follow up with people to see how that really landed and impacted and lives within them. But I think, you know, we tried to accomplish so much with Kamloops. I think even just introducing this concept of witnessing has been quite powerful. It also frames the paradigm in the sense that it's not prioritizing settlerism, that we, in by entrenching it in this Indigenous protocol of witnessing, it directly communicates that the settler gaze is not prioritized, which is was intentional.
I think just to follow that up, because this was such, this really struck me about the play before I even saw it, was I heard that you weren't accepting reviews of the play. And, you know, just thinking about decolonizing your approach, that just is like, whoa. Okay, so, like, can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think, too, if our intent was to have protocol and ceremony, and if I was going to call it medicine, and I do feel that it is our medicine, I think it would have been hypocritical and undermining all of the work we were doing to then be like, and please, predominantly white settler men, come and critique it. It just felt backwards. I felt like I wasn't actually following the words and the ideologies that I was trying to promote of preserving Indigenous matriarchy and female voices and Indigenous lived experiences. So we did. We put an embargo on critics of really any kind, of any critical consumption was not allowed with Kamloopa, and we had a community of practice to talk to the reviewers about what that was. I have to give them so many thanks, or maybe not. Somebody said I need to stop thanking people for doing shit they're supposed to do. Oh my God, am I allowed to swear? Okay. If you've seen Kamloopa, you know that I swear. I'm actually surprised I lasted that long.
Almost 20 minutes.
I know. Is the fact that we wanted to explain them to this. Again, another teaching and an offer. And for me, it just felt like when I'm being gifted things, that it's really important that I receive them. It also felt so entitled that as a male settler, you would think you've been positioned to have any authority over Indigenous matriarchal content. That's just not how I live. Like, that's just, that would be like me going in and thinking that I could, with all my quote unquote expertise, review Black Panther or those things. That there, that's just not, I am not the expert in those fields. So we offered the teachings of having a level of humility to say, I don't know, I am not the expert. This is not for me. I know there are some controversies around it, but I just watched Crazy Rich Asians last night. And in the scene between the two mothers when they're playing Mahjong, I don't know that game. And I could see that there was Asian-centric, complex storytelling going on in there. And I knew it wasn't for me, and I was so freaking glad that it wasn't for me. And I knew that it was powerful in a way that was about the Asian diaspora. And that is A-okay, and that really was what Kamloopa was. And the reviewers obliged, not only obliged, but Jerry Wasserman from VancouverPlays.com created space for Indigenous women to write love letters about their experience, because I would not go to a wedding or a synagogue and write a review. That's just not how I would feel comfortable. What I think we can do is when we participate in ceremonies, talk about the impact that it had on us and celebrate that, because I think that's the most important part, and that was a big part of it too, about the process being the art. It was about creating space for Indigenous voices to be centered, so that not only we were refusing white settler critical consumption, we were actually creating space for Indigenous matriarchal voices to be celebrated. Because there's, you know, I'm sure in the literary arts and in the performance arts and the visual arts, there are so many inequities around having our experts in our community speak about our work. It's like too much like square peg round hole shit. It's like, get over yourselves. But I need a little bit more respect in that statement. I think it's a journey for us with them to negotiate. For Break My Neck show, I don't know what that will be, but I think I'm kind of over critics. I don't think critics also sell shows anymore. That's a false narrative. We had an almost sold-out run in the culture with zero critics. So I don't think institutions have to lean so hard on them anymore. We worked very hard to create a lot of content, but and you don't think we need them. And the less we need settler authority over our work, the better.
Once again, with the oral tradition, I love it. That was how I kept hearing about Kamloopa, was especially just my, like, the Indigenous woman in my life, the family and friends, everybody's talking about it. And then everybody, like you said, is sharing it after. And
that's the most, I find, compelling way to go see art. That's how I see art. I text the friends and the people in my life that I love and respect and can relate to and say, what are you seeing? You know, Dana Claxton's piece at the Vag is going on right now. I see what my friends are posting about. I don't usually go to white dudes and be like, what are you engaging with these days? I'm sure it relates to me. You know what? I've done that for 30 years of my life. I have tried to put my understandings through the eyes of a white man, and I'm fucking over it.
Does anyone else have any questions?
You mentioned the love letters. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
Yeah, so we put a call out to some matriarchs within the industry and also community members who were coming back again and again and again. And we just asked them to talk about their experience. So a lot of it was talking about them feeling powerful, them feeling like they had agency, and also that some of these women had never been seen in art before, which really brought me to tears when I read that one. because I can't, I come from a lot of privilege. And to hear some of our community members with so much heart and so much truth say that they have never seen themselves in art before, it really angered me. I grieve that, but I'm also elated that something like Kamloops could do that and them given the space to speak about that, because I think that is often not understood, that our people don't see ourselves in the work as much as we should. You know, there was this thing that happened the other day. I was going for a long, long walk, and I saw three lawyers, like, coming out of the courts, like, down near Robson Square. Two of them, they're all men. Two of them were men of color. And I, like, stopped. I've never seen that before, like visible people of color. And it just gave me this sense of, like, I don't know if they were, like, morally good people, but I just was like, yeah, like, you go into those courts, you men of color, and you represent us. And I think that those little moments that we get to recognize ourselves in these systems where we've been so absent and kept out of and deliberately pushed away from is important. And I think that's what the love letters did. And I think I would do that again, again too, because we wanted them to flood the internet. I didn't want to Google Kamloops and see five reviews by, like, settler men. I wanted to see, like, my aunties be like, it's a real gooder, you know? Like, that's how I would go see a play. Yes. That's how, exactly what you're saying. I would trust the aunties and the sisters and the moms of my community more than anyone else. And I think we as artists and Indigenous women need to invest that authority into our peers. I don't need to see a poster with a critical acclaim. I want to see a poster with my aunties talking about what it meant for them. And that's something that we're thinking about for the next show too, because I egotistically fall into that, like, oh, dang, we can't really say critically acclaimed, eh? And they didn't acclaim. In fact, we told them to be quiet. So how do we actually promote that show? And I think, again, investing, and that's why I'm so happy to be here in this program, you know, unceded airways, we're sitting around with a bunch of women investing in the authority and the expertise that lives within this group. That's what I think we need to be doing more.
Yeah, and we were so excited to have you here, and it kind of was just automatically, we talked about this in the first episode, where a lot of our minds went as well, like, this is the kind of stuff we're engaged in. We were all talking about the art we were excited about, and that was just, like, where our minds went right away.
Yeah, and I think too, like, I think it's important that we talk about it all together. And sometimes, you know, Desmond Cole is an incredible Black journalist from Toronto that I follow and I got to meet. And we had a long conversation one time when we were at this conference about pluralism. And he was talking about the fact that, Kim, sometimes you're going to have to protect these spaces, these matriarchal, Indigenous-centric spaces, for us to have these conversations to say, you know what, this impacted me this way or this impacted me the other way. I think too often we're also pushed and positioned to have to speak about any kind of critical challenges we experience in our community so publicly, whereas, you know, white settlerism have so many spaces where privately they can discuss things within their communities. And so that's something I'm also really interested in art creation, is how do we have these really important and complex and in-depth conversations about making excellent art in very complicated situations that doesn't always have to be so public. You know, I'm recognizing that my life is becoming a little public, and I'm more interested in having discourse with matrix and Indigenous women to then create that foundation for the work. Because we also had all women in the design room, all female cast. We had days where there were just no men in the room ever. That was rare. When does that ever happen? When do you go a day when you don't have to engage a male counterpart in a workspace? And then we know the settler gaze and the white gaze and the male gaze, it has an impact. And so I think that's also really important to those spaces, creating those spaces. I keep going back to why Kamloops. I'm really in love with the necessity to create spaces exactly like we have right now, because they're not often enough. There's too many inequities in the sector.
Mm-hmm. So talking about spaces, you know, thinking about whatever room that Kamloops is playing in and the many people who are watching it, like, what do you think was happening in that space? You do have settler gazes and you also have Indigenous women watching and experiencing it completely differently. Like, what did you feel or see or think was happening in each room?
Well, I went to almost every show just to watch the audience, the witnesses. As a writer, it's really important for me to know when people lean in, when they start laughing, when they relate, when they grab their sister's or their cousin's hand or their auntie or their mom's hand, or they lean in for a hug. I was almost obsessive about that, and I learned a lot about how strong or how compelling the narrative were in different moments. Even from the Vancouver or the Coast Salish premiere, when we moved to Treaty 6, I took a scene out, we knocked it down the first act by 7 minutes, we knocked 5 minutes off the second act. Like, I really used it as a study here in Vancouver. And when people are like, don't touch it, I'm like, I'm not going to be too precious about this. I really want to make sure that we're effective and we're utilizing each moment. I'll give you a couple examples. So there was, on one of the nights on the Coast Salish, we had a lot of Indigenous women, and there was like a lot of, like, my friend Oz used to talk about it, where it's so weird in the settler environments where to participate, we have to like raise our hand and formally engage or not. Whereas like in Longhouse and Ceremony, our elders and matriarchs and patriarchs would be like, hey, hey, ho, ho, hey. Like, you'd have a verbal audible that would allow you to support or not support. And it wouldn't take so much time. Like, what is it, Robert's Rules? Like, all that crap around holding a meeting, and it's like so pedantic. And whereas Indigenous spaces, we're voting with our energy, our faces, our audibles all of the time, and that happened a lot. I had the Indigenous sisters cheering or high-fiving or laughing, and then the settlers are looking at them like, I didn't get it, or I don't know. And so I have to commend the courage of those women who continued to do that, because it is a brave thing to publicly participate in something. I then, you know, for example, for a settler experience, I haven't even really had time to unpack this, but an elderly white man said to his elderly white wife, the show is exhausting to watch.
Oh.
What? Yeah. And I was kind of like, probably. You know, like, but I was right behind him, and he physically looked exhausted beyond his age. He was like, the show is exhausting to watch. And his wife was like, like, they look, and I was like, welcome to every day of my life. I'm exhausted all of the time trying to filter settlerism and white supremacy. So I think a lot of people left exhausted. I think a lot of people might have left worked, which I was really interested in. But then also I had really generous settler audience members come and say, I understood to a point, and I'm glad that I didn't understand at all, or I understand the indigenous-centric portrayals of these women that you're trying to do. You know, Edith, I had someone tell me that Edith, which is Indian friend number one, that they were like, is she a red herring? Like, does she come at the end with her foster care narrative, and is it a red herring? Should we introduce that sooner? And I said, you know, there's a woman in the Indigenous community in my life that I encounter where you're at a powwow or the Friendship Center or an Indigenous event, and she's got like four babies and she's there by herself and she's trying to feed them and they're going to the washroom. And then you just take a baby and you put them on your hip. And then you've got a baby in your hand and one on your hip, and she's saying thank you. She's changing a diaper and coming back. And you have this, like, Indigenous women just know. We know when we need help. We know when it's our time to take space. We know when it's our time to not take space. And that, to me, was an introduction into Indigenous narratives that was Edith. It is not a friend who comes in and is not trying to monopolize and say, this is my story and my time, and have her little moment. Edith, for me, was that woman who knew Micaiah and Kalana needed a friend, and that they didn't need to know her name in that moment. She knew when her name needed to be presenced. She knew when her story needed to be present. And there's a gracefulness that I don't see in Indigenous narratives enough that speak to these Indigenous matriarchal specific women. And so I was like, she's not a red herring. She's somebody that I know in my life. She's somebody that is intrinsically Indigenous that I think settlers need to observe more. But so I think a lot of settlers came in trying to squeeze Kamloops into a Eurocentric form or frame and failed. And so I hope as we move forward, they come with an open heart to receive what it is that we're trying to teach and them to witness.
Yeah. It just reminds me, just what you're sharing reminds me of, like, such a powerful moment at the very beginning when you asked all the Indigenous women to stand up. Mm. And just the impact that it had on the room. There's way more women than I thought that there was.
Yeah, how did that go for you? I'm interested to hear what that made you feel like.
It made me feel seen.
Yeah.
What about
you? No, you're right. It felt like that exact act of claiming the space. You know, if people didn't know before, they knew right then. And you just looked around at each other and also really saw each other. You know, someone that you might not have seen at the other end of your row, who is also with their aunt or cousin, you saw, and you knew that you guys were going into that together.
That's great. That's exactly what we were trying to go for, because I think, again, too many times we're not acknowledged, we're not able to recognize ourselves, or people, you know, try and say, oh, I didn't know she was Native, and using their imaginary Indian understanding of who we are. And so in that moment, one, a little short story, when we first did that, the first preview in Kamloops, we had just rehearsed it and practiced it, and then when we finally did it, said we'd like to invite all the Matrix to stand up and just present yourselves. Like, 10 women stood up and tears jumped from my eyes. I forgot how powerful that was going to be. And for the 3 men on stage, like Kaylin Yon, she won't mind me saying it, she burst into tears. She was like, we haven't even started. And she was already crying. And then another night, and this is really why we did it, a young Indigenous girl, you know, we said, you know, please stand up and feel comfortable. Well, this little Indigenous girl looked up at her mom. She goes, Mom, is that me? And her mom looked down and said, that's you. And then they both stood up. The power of seeing what that is to mean to own who it is, who we are, and publicly presence ourselves as matriarchs. That little girl will forever be in my heart and my mind whenever I'm battling these settler systems of oppression. But that was very important. But, you know, my mom, she's so freaking generous. You know what she said after she saw that in Kamloops? She was like, I think all the women should stand up. And I was like, okay, why do you think that, Mom? She was like, I think so many women are not seen. And I was like, totally. But you also, as an Indigenous woman, must recognize how even less Indigenous women are asked to presence themselves. And she was like, I guess so, but I just think we should all stand up. I was like, oh, you're way kinder than me, Mom. I was like, it's our moment, everyone else, you bear witness to this.
Well, another thing it brought to my mind too was kind of that I felt like I saw in the play as well, was like the erasure specifically of Indigenous women's bodies. Like, you were making all the bodies really present in that room. And then I was just thinking about, you know, like the physical response, like the hyperventilating, that worry, but then also the body pride of Indian friend number one, when she comes out, you know, she like smacks her ass and is like all proud.
Yeah, for sure.
I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that, about like the body pride and body awareness.
Yeah, I think, and this is, you know, I get serious real quick on this. I think Indigenous female bodies have not been our own for far too long. I think settlers and the hypersexualization and the erasure, exactly what you're saying, of Indigenous female bodies is something we don't even look at anymore. So we wanted, I wanted an array of what Indigenous female bodies actually looked like. I wanted us to use our bodies. I was really bored with some portrayals of women where we're just kind of these talking heads, and it's just like, I feel like it's just like chickens. Like, we're just so disassociated with like leaning over and having our roles shown, and like jumping over the couch and having us in an unattractive position. I had to work against the actors who wanted to like present sometimes, and I said, I don't actually give an F about what your face is doing. I need you to just own your body, because your body's gonna start speaking to people. You know, it was dancing, it was physical comedy, it was when they tore the apartment, when they turn into the animals. I deliberately wanted the body to have a level of sovereignty and a reclamatory aspect to that back. And I'm really happy that people were picking up on that people really were feeling like, I left feeling confident, I left feeling beautiful, I left seeing my body in ways that I don't get to see it that often. And that's going to be something that I think all women need to see that more, that like Yolanda, like she wrote a great article on how fat is not a bad word. She's like, I'm a fat Indian and I love it. I love the way my body moves. She's a remarkable mover. Of course she is. Same with Kaitlyn Yon and Samantha Brown. But we talked a lot about how the fact that we have been programmed and patriarchy has tried to separate what it means for our bodies to be our own, and how we own them and live in them and breathe in them and move in them. And that was a deliberate choice. Even in the next show, I'm saying that I want more body communication, and so we're going to be integrating more dance and movement into that so that we don't just rely on oral vocabulary of a language. I think what lives within me and Monique Mojica talks about is this idea of blood memory, mm-hmm. of how art can speak to our bodies and how it can like elicit something inside of us to get us moving. And I think we need to invest, and I'm really interested in exploring what that actually is, of getting into a space and playing a drum song. You know, when we hear the drum, I don't hear it and intellectualize a song. I feel the drum. The drum elicits a confidence that, like, goes down to my loins, that, you know, like, that just, it ignites something inside of me that no monologue can do, that no great two-hander scene could ever do, that when I hear music, when I see dance, when I see us move in space, there's something fully articulate about whatever that is, I will always hire a movement person from now on, because it was like a lot for me to try and handle that. So I also have to really thank the three performers who were just incredible movers and willing to go there. But also, it was challenging in the rehearsal hall sometimes, of the girls having to, you know, Yolanda's wearing a beaded G-string and she has to do that every night. And some days, you know, we don't feel so great about our body. So, you know, again, in the idea of health and wellness, we gave her two options. One was the like, go for it. And the other one was on days that she wasn't feeling it. We had a little, like, I don't know. I don't think I've spoken about this yet. Like a little flap cover, like, that we could put on it if she wasn't feeling it. And we wouldn't get we wouldn't get that moment of body sovereignty, of cheering. Yeah. But I also wanted to be that I've been forced to wear costumes and been forced to feel something about my body when I wasn't into it some days. But now to come think of it, we never used it. Yolanda, and that, I'm kind of proud of that, that Yolanda felt comfortable each night doing that. And that was fun choreography too, because her butt is actually out for like half the scene.
Yeah.
And nobody notices it till the very end, and there's a lot of weird backwards upstage acting happening where she was like, this looks messed up, nobody walks around like this. I was like, it'll be worth it, it'll be fine. I was like, we'd have a bear and a coyote downstairs, nobody's looking up at you.
No. You could not tell.
Yeah. So that's the body sovereignty was a really huge piece for me. Also, too, because I wanted us as women to invest in what that meant. So to spend time in the rehearsal period of reconnecting and falling in love what it means to be who we are in all of our entirety, as I think also the women leaving were saying, you know, we had a woman who, she said she was just getting over her treatment for cancer, and she was having a really hard time negotiating her relationship to her body. And she was saying to just bear witness to these women, to use, you know, their right toe all the way to the top of their left finger, that that doesn't happen enough in art. We don't see women, unless it's dance and some performance works, but in theater specifically, I don't see females' bodies moving enough, and I don't see women of color's bodies moving enough, and I definitely don't see Indigenous female bodies moving enough in a non-sexual, but a sovereignly sexual autonomy over what it is that we do with our bodies. And that was the other big thing too, that everyone had to have agency over what they wanted to do. I didn't care. I didn't have a set of blocking in my mind about what they needed to do. They needed to figure out their own journey for coming there. And we did some pretty cool investigations. Like we did like an hour and a half, I don't even know what it's called, of just kind of like creating worlds of them transforming into animals. And they were able to create a language around what felt natural to them. You know, I didn't need Sam Brown on her hind legs growling around like a bear. You know, like that's not what the vernacular for her like body language is going to be. And so that was really interesting too. But I think, yeah, a lot of comments around how people, the use and diversity of body. But again, that's the women that I know. Mm-hmm. The women in my life. And I also think theater has a really, I was going to swear, has a really big problem with not having diverse and inclusive bodies on stage. I don't think size 4 women are the only women in my life who get to fall in love. Mm-hmm. They don't get to be the ingenues all the time. I have full figured, petite framed, tall, short, big, fat, thin, muscular, non-binary, diverse, inclusive looking women falling in love and having agency over their lives and sexuality all of the time. And theater needs to get its act together.
Yeah. All right. There's so much more to talk about, but we do need to take just a little brief break, and then we'll be back in the studio with Kim Harvey.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
This Quarter Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, This Quarter lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of This Quarter Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Check it out, y'all. 무덤덤해져가는 서로의 감정 때문에 상처를 주는 것조차도 이제 무덤덤한 우리 이미 사랑은 떠났고 정밖에 남지 않아서 그냥 그런가 하고 뜨뜸이 지근해졌지 관심은 집착이 되어버리고 웃음은 거의 밥 먹듯이 해 너와 내가 쌓았던 신뢰란 성은 무너지고 넌 이제 이별길을 걸으며 새 사람을 찾지
다 지우기 위해 널 만난 건 아닌데
눈물이 난다
상처받기 위해 쌓은 추억이 아닌데
잊혀져간다
너무 쉽게 또 한 사람과 남이 돼
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire, Cheetos, police material, and Discord.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heck and want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute. Just visit citr.ca/discorder/contribute. You can grab it around town or read it at discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded, traditional, and current lands of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples. The time is 2:44 p.m., and we're in the studio with writer and director of Kamloopa, Kim Harvey, and we're about to listen to some tape by Jamuna, featuring Anishinaabe reporter Tanya Talaga. Want to quickly tell us what we're about to hear?
Yeah, this was just collected at the Massey Lectures, which took place last month. And if we just play it, you'll get the idea. Elder Sequalia Wanak giving part of the opening prayers for the Vancouver Massey Lectures that took place on October 23rd and 24th. Tanya Talaga is this year's CBC Massey Lecturer. This is an annual opportunity for one scholar or writer to create five lectures about an important issue going on in society.
Anin Buzu, it's wonderful to be here tonight in Vancouver on the unceded territory of the Squamish, Musqueam, and the Tsleil-Waututh First Nations.
This is the first time that an Indigenous woman has given the Massey Lectures, and only the second time that an Indigenous person has delivered them since they began in 1961. On stage, she stands against a backdrop of colorful artwork. The skirt she wears appears to have the Ojibwe alphabet, or at least the characters written all across it. The white letters pop against the black fabric.
And you know, it's funny, when the CBC asked me to be the Massey lecturer, well, there's a whole long story with that, to be honest with you, because I'm like, what? Are you sure? Me? You must have the wrong person. But I also said to them, okay, all right. Well, you know, after I just sort of thought about it for a while, I thought, okay, I will do this, but I have some conditions. And one of those conditions where we would start the Massey lectures in Thunder Bay, which is what we did, and I needed to be there for a whole host of reasons, including that's where my grandmother's from, that's where my mother's from, that's where my grandmother's grandmothers are from, and those are where my stories are from. I had to be there. And I also said, too, you know, Philip, that was Philip that you saw up here. I always talk about Philip at all the beginnings of my lectures, too. I said, you know, if we're going to do the Massey lectures, I want to have them different. I'm not going to be standing by like a lecture podium and just sort of talking. I need to have culture and music and art, because that's who Indigenous people are. And so much more. And that also, too, makes me feel better. I got to say, it makes me feel better when I hear the drum. And so that's actually also a big part of the reason why I wanted all this with me. It gives me hope and it gives me strength.
Tanya is Ojibwe and Polish by ancestry. She is a mother, a writer, and an established investigative journalist who has been working with the Toronto Star for over 2 decades. Most recently, she has become one of the lead advocates to raise awareness about the high rate of suicide in Indigenous communities, both here in Canada and around the world.
When I started these lectures, I looked at youth suicide. I do look at youth suicide. But I realized when I started my research, after talking to all these doctors and health scientists and reading all these research papers and not finding any answers as to why and how to stop things and how to make things better, I realized I was looking in the wrong places. I realized I needed to go backwards. I needed to go look at the beginnings of who we are, how we got here, and I needed to tell those stories. And I also needed to tell stories of belonging. And tonight I'm going to be talking a lot about belonging, because I found that at the heart of what I was researching and looking at, this very much is a story about belonging.
The reason Tanya has gotten recognition through the Massey Lectures is because of her book, Seven Fallen Feathers. In it, she describes the stories of 7 Indigenous youth who have lost their lives while in the child welfare system in Thunder Bay, Ontario. The book was published in 2017 and has won many awards. Her latest book, All Our Relations, is a collection of her 5 Massey lectures strung together. Before she took to stage, I had the privilege of asking Tanya a few questions. I met her in the green room, and the first thing I noticed when I walked in was the sweet smell of sage that had been freshly burned. She said she had just smudged. Tanya has a calm demeanor and quietly waited as I pulled out my gear. Please excuse the echoey sound of the green room and how far away my voice sounds. I was a little starstruck and pretty determined to point the mic at Tanya. How do you think being an Indigenous woman impacts the work that you do? And does it open doors or does it present more challenges? What do you think?
I think the work that I do is because of who I am, and I wouldn't be telling the stories that I do if I didn't have my background. And my background is mixed too. My father was Polish. It's my mom's family that is Ojibwe. And all of those things, my background, where I was raised in Toronto, where my mother grew up, and how the time that I spent there in Northern Ontario, that all influences me and what I saw and what I chose to write about when I got older.
Last year when you spoke to us, I remember you describing that you wrote 7 Fallen Feathers while you're still working full time and you had your kids and you woke up early and you'd do this. And
that's
so
right.
I'm wondering what advice you give to young Indigenous women, mothers who are taking care of their families, taking care of their duties, but still have important work to share with the world.
it's not easy, but you do it because you feel also that you have a responsibility to do things too. It's like, you know, you want to tell stories, and you feel like you really need to sort of get this out there. And it's hard. I mean, you have to juggle, and you have to rely a lot on family. I mean, I rely a lot on my own mom. She really helps me, and she takes care of my kids for me too. And she always has. That is a big help to me. She lives in Toronto now, and so she is able to come to my house and take care of my kids. And it's a lot on my children too, and it's a lot on any mom that's a single mother and has to do, well, you have to eat, you have to feed your children, and you want to be creative. You know, you're lucky, and I feel lucky that I'm in a spot that I could do those things. I mean, I write for a living as a journalist, and then I was able to write more in the mornings and at night, but I love it. And that's what I feel sort of comfortable doing is writing, and I feel compelled to do that. But it's not easy. I mean, you have to rely on so many things, like so many people to help you. And that's hard, but it's also puts another perspective on the relationship you might have with other women in your family that help you look after your kids too, and you realize how important they are and how much of they are to you.
Yeah, thank you. Last question. You're dealing with such heavy material, like it's such a heavy issue. How do you take care of yourself?
There are better times and there are worse times. I mean, sometimes it's easier for me. I can go outside. I can run, and that physically helps me a lot. What also helps me a lot are things like my elder, Sam Ashney-Panescom. He's with me here on this tour. We just smudged. You just missed it. And that helps. Ceremony helps. Keeping in contact with everyone back home, being out in the community helps. Hearing other stories, the strength of women, the strength of families, that helps me a lot. The strength of community, that helps.
Thank you.
Miigwech.
The message of the night is complex. Indigenous youth suicide cannot be boiled down to any one thing. But no matter what the conversation, a legacy of colonialism seems to be at the bottom of it all. One of her takeaways was pretty clear.
I talk a lot about what's happened in the past. I talk a lot about what's needed in the future. My lectures go on and they talk about a span of different things, but I'm gonna go off here for one little moment and talk about something that maybe that could happen now. Because when I'm in communities, when I'm talking to people, and today when I was at the Vancouver Aboriginal Friendship Center, this is something that was talked about with me. We talked about sexual abuse, and we talked about, actually, somebody brought up to me something I've heard time and time again, so it's something I think I need to say here tonight, and that is about the creation of safe houses in communities. You know, I think it's an incredible thing, and I've heard that from coast to coast to coast. Why do we not have places in communities where children can feel safe to go to at night? These places should be run by women in the community too. Women who are especially trained and who understand what it's like to give a safe, loving home. I'm throwing that out there, Canada, because I have the platform of the Massey Lectures to talk about that. So I leave that in your hands.
Okay, so there would be a lot to talk about there, and you guys do different kinds of creation and writing, but what are some of the things that stuck out to you from listening to that?
Right now, my what I'm really thinking about is this idea of creating these communities, of reclaiming exactly what Tanya's talking about, of these Indigenous-centric ways of relating. I was thinking a few months ago, I was talking to someone about this idea about the death of the public life, where I got to visit Europe last year, and there was this idea of that, like, you kind of go out on a Tuesday, and you grab a glass of wine, you go to an art gallery, and you walk home with people, and you sit at a cafe, and you hang out with each other in communion a lot more than in North America. We go out by ourselves, we put our iPad, our earbuds in, we go to our own cars, into our own apartments, into our own dorms, into our own lives, and I'm frightened by that, because I don't think that's actually how we can live in a healthy, balanced way. And when she's talking about these spaces where our children can go to, these spaces where us as women can gather, I crave that a lot. And, you know, and I was just thinking, and like, I hope you don't mind me sharing this, a little text came up that said, I miss you. Yeah. And I thought, you know, oh my God, I shouldn't look at that, or oh God, I can't believe I saw that. But then I'm like, I think it's really important that we see each other, have these levels of joy and happiness and share and love, and that we are brave enough to bear witness to each other's lives more intimately, with more detail, which I think will allow us to take care of each other in a better way. And so that's where my brain goes with this. I'm getting to the age where I'm considering having children, and I refuse to have a child until I have a strong community. And being in spaces like this and relating to women like this is incredibly important, to know that maybe one day my little cousins or the kid can listen to this, and that there's spaces for them, because I think that's really hard. And with regards to creative and arts and life, I think it's all one. And so I think we need these spaces so we can hold space for our leaders to lead, for our fishermen to fish, for our hunters to hunt, and for our women to be our matriarchal powers. And but that's what really, and when I keep hearing her talk, I think it's about this idea of these indigenous-centric spaces, but community, and the new relationship we're going to need to create with settlers so we can bear witness and intersect with their lives. But I think that's where my brain goes, is I want to create stronger communities. That's what I was saying, you know, off air, being here in this space, spending time with everyone in this room is just as important to me as Kamloopa itself. If, like I said, if not more, it's that important to me.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kim. We really appreciate you making the time to share your wisdom with us, and thank you. And thank you for all our listeners for tuning in. Marcy Cho. Tweet us, find us on Facebook at Unceded Airwaves. Tell us what you think. Find this episode or others at citr.ca. And no end, that's all.
Unceded Airwaves is produced by Indigenous and non-Indigenous allied volunteers. If you'd like to volunteer with us, tweet us or email volunteer@citr.ca.
Tune in for our next show on November 21st. You've been listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, Huichoksa.